Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed Toward Justice. I am Rabia Chaudhry. I am your host, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller. Hi, Colin.
Hey, Rabia. How's it going?
It's going well. We had to do some shuffling this week because this is a story that I thought really clearly has some urgency, but I wanted to talk about this before next week, before the middle of next week. So I'm really excited to get our guests on because it was very last minute. So I'm going to introduce them. We're just going to get kind of right into it. We have joining us today attorneys Matt Schulz and Donna Venable, both who are attorneys with the Federal Defender's Office. Matt and Donna, welcome. Nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I've met you a little briefly a couple of days ago, but it's nice to meet you again. And thank you for having us and giving us the opportunity to talk about this case.
Yeah, a couple of days ago, I had the pleasure of doing a virtual press conference, emceeing it, and Matt was on that press conference to talk about the case we're going to talk about today, and that's the first time we crossed paths. But today, we're going to be talking about the fact that next week, on March 12th, a man by the name of Sonny Burton, who is incarcerated in Alabama, is on Alabama's death row, is going to be executed. He is slated for execution on March 12th, and Matt, Donna, and an entire team of people are fighting hard to get his execution commuted and, you know, save his life. So, Matt, I was told that you have been on this case for over 17 years.
Yes. Yeah. 17 and a half years. As a matter of fact, when I started at the Federal Defender's Office in 2008, and I was trying to figure out even what to do, his former first chair, lead counsel, knew that his case was being shifted over to me, and his was the first box of materials put on my desk.
Wow. You took over the case after the conviction, is what you're saying?
Yes, actually well after the conviction and totally after both rounds. They get three rounds of appeals, two through the state courts and then one in federal courts to which they have a right. And our office is authorized to represent people in their federal habeas corpus appeals. That's a fancy way of saying their federal constitutional claims, essentially.
And Donna, can you tell us a little bit about your involvement in the case and how long you've been working on it with Matt?
Yeah, so I joined this office back in 2022, so pretty recently. And Mr. Burton was one of my first clients. I've been assigned to his case since I began employment here at the Federal Defenders of the Middle District of Alabama. So he's been in what we call clemency or end stage proceedings the entire time that I've been on his case. And so I've been able to see, you know, the massive amount of work that the team, all of the attorneys, investigators, paralegals have done before me that got us to this moment. And then, you know, I'd also like to say, you know, our current investigator and paralegal, Elena Encarnacion, is our investigator, and Nancy Palombi is our current paralegal. They've done just such a massive amount of work, even since I've been here. So 3 years to get us to this moment. And we're so proud that we're able to share Sonny's story, and we hope that it makes a difference.
Yeah, and if I could chime in just really quick, just to give one more prop to those two individuals. Elena was just, she's done so many things, but she also put together our entire clemency film, which is amazing, and it's available on www.charlessonnyburton.com, and it's Sonny is S-O-N-N-Y, and Charles Burton, as you would normally spell it. And then Nancy has actually known Sonny even a little longer than I have, because she's been in the office longer, and the team is just an amazing team. I couldn't ask for a better team to work with.
I mean, that's an incredible amount of dedication. We will definitely, by the way, share the links to Sonny's website and so folks can check out that film. But, you know, Matt, I think we have to start off by doing what we normally do on the show, which is like kind of set up what happened. What happened in 1991? You know, start with the underlying crime for which Sonny was convicted.
Sure. You know, there are so many interesting ways to kind of introduce this, sometimes coming right out of the gate with these, you know, the big injustices and that sort of thing. This is a nice way to introduce it, I think, as well. Let's talk about what happened on that day. On that day in 1991, Charles Burton and five other men, six total, admittedly made a decision, decided they were going to rob someplace. Between them all, some others suggested the AutoZone store in Talladega. They went in. Mr. Burton was in the store with the others. They were armed. Again, we're admitting he was involved in an armed robbery. Cutting through all of, you don't need to know every last detail, but let's talk about the most important ones. Everyone participated in the robbery. People were taking money from, you know, Sonny went back and got money out of the safe with the manager. Others were taking some money off of some of the customers and that sort of thing. They left the store. Sonny and three of the others left the store. So there were two remaining in the store. After the others, including Sonny, had left the store, one of the co-defendants, Derek DeBruce, in the store shot the totally innocent victim in this case, who did nothing more than stop to purchase something at an AutoZone store. And that individual, Mr. Doug Battle, ended up losing his life. So he was killed by Derek DeBruce. Mr. Burton, again, was not only in the store, he didn't even hear the gunshot go off, did not know that anyone had been shot until they were driving away. And he was furious when that happened. So that's the gist of what happened. So, of course, the question then arises, okay, you can maybe see this is a capital offense for the person who pulled the trigger and shot, but how is this a capital offense for Charles Burton?
Well, I have a couple of questions, but I also want to point out that the victim, Doug Battle, he was a 34-year-old father of four, apparently, and he was a customer there. He didn't even work there, right?
Right.
Right.
He was a customer who had come in.
So did all of these perps come to the store together?
Yes.
Was every single one of them armed, including Sonny?
I believe they were all armed, yes.
Okay. Were they like immediately caught? Like, I mean, was this one of these things where they didn't realize Sonny's involvement until later? How long did that take? Do you know?
It didn't take them very long. I think it was on some of these facts that, you know, hazy after the fact, but it did not take very long. Most of these crimes often don't. You know, you get enough people, somebody knows somebody and they identify someone and then it all sort of falls together. So this did not take long. It's not like there were months or years involved.
So six people were involved. All six are charged? Is that what happened?
Well, all six were charged with something.
Okay.
The youngest, who was 16 at the time, and it ended up turning state's evidence, as they say, mm-hmm. he ended up making a deal with the state, and he testified, got a much lesser sentence than everyone else. Everyone else was prosecuted for a form of murder at different levels, and that kind of helps get into, you know, the differentiation between the types of murderers. But Derek DeBruce and Charles Burton were both convicted of capital murder. So
I did want to point out, not everybody was charged. What about Sportio?
Oh, well, I mean, the six defendants who went in to rob the AutoZone store. Yes, there was another individual. This isn't really part of the case record, which is why I didn't bring it up. And it's, you know, neither here nor there with a lot of the facts, but there was another individual who really was the mastermind of the thing. As often happens in these cases, the smartest person involved doesn't go and doesn't involve himself. He sends other people.
There's
a buffer and they're not involved.
Were they a gang? Was it a gang?
Not really a gang, just a group of people who know each other. They were not a gang. They were just a group of people who had been doing this sort of thing before. I mean, admittedly, it's not like Mr. Burton did not have a criminal history. He had a significant criminal history.
At the time as well.
Yes. Yeah. He had spent most of his life in and out of jail. He was living pretty much homeless on his own by the time he was 15. That doesn't justify anything. I'm just saying he had an extremely abusive childhood from his father and a rough childhood, and then kind of got into, that was the only family he had. He had other family who loved him very much, but he felt that connection with people on the streets, and that was where he was living, and couch surfing and that sort of thing too. And so that was, yeah.
And he hadn't known the folks for very long, right?
Not for very long, no. He had just kind of been introduced to them fairly recently.
Thanks for joining us this week, folks. I want to remind you that our sponsors are the reason that we can keep the show going. It's the reason we can help so many people who are behind bars. It's the reason that we can continue to fight injustice. So please make sure to check out our sponsors, patronize our products. Colin and I approve every single one of these products that we have on our show. We are very selective about the sponsors that come on, and we are so grateful to them for their support. With every passing year, a lot of us become more and more aware of our wellness needs. But guess what? Along with you, your furry best friend is also aging every single year. So have you thought about your pet's health and how to be more intentional about your dog's wellness? Growing up, I worked in my dad's veterinary clinic, and we saw it all the time. Folks would come in with their dog acting in all kinds of weird behaviors, you know, just shaking their heads, they're eating grass, their ears are itching, prone to ear infections, you know. They'd be suffering from diarrhea and poor digestion, and of course, itching and scratching and rubbing and just generally not comfortable. These are not normal dog behaviors, and they are actually signs of allergies. Allergies in dogs often start in the gut. It can show up everywhere, in issues with their skin, ears, digestion, and energy. And just like us, dogs need good bacteria to strengthen their gut health and calm an overactive immune system. That's why I recommend Better Wild Allergy Relief Soft Chews. They are designed to support your pet's allergy defenses by strengthening digestion and helping restore balance from the inside. They are the first and only ones with Ancestral Advantage Wolf Probiotics and other natural ingredients proven to help reduce itching and support gut, immune, and skin health. Better Wild Allergy Supplement Chews have four key ingredients. There is a premium blend of wolf probiotics called the Ancestral Advantage. It is designed to rewild your dog's gut. There's L-sacchii, a postbiotic derived from kimchi that's been clinically proven to reduce itchiness and redness in just 2 months with daily use. The supplements have colostrum to boost immune function and fight inflammation, and salmon oil to support healthy skin and fur. Better Wild is committed to helping your dogs with clinically proven, veterinarian-approved solutions that you can feel great about. And right now, Better Wild is offering our listeners up to 40% off your order at betterwild.com/justice. That's betterwild.com/justice for up to 40% off your order. betterwild.com/justice. So, I mean, like, can you tell us what Sonny was charged with and why?
Sure. You know, and we don't have to go through all the procedural aspects of it, but as far as the trial itself, this kind of gets into, so it would be helpful if I delineate the difference between felony and capital murder. In most states, and sometimes they don't call it necessarily felony murder, but that's what it is, so I'll describe what it is. Let's say, for instance, and this is a good example that seems to get into people's minds. Rabia, let's say that tonight you and I decided to hold up a liquor store. I don't think we're going to
totally
do that.
Likely.
Totally likely. But let's say we both go crazy and we decide we're going to hold up a liquor store. And you know that I have a 38 on me and that I am armed. So this is going to be an armed robbery. Now, that's an inherently dangerous activity that can qualify for what is known as felony murder. In other words, a murder takes place during the course of an armed robbery, then the person who commits the murder, obviously the person who shoots it, that's murder in and of itself without even needing it to be felony murder. But any accomplices who were involved in that dangerous activity are technically guilty, or at least potentially guilty, of felony murder. And we admit wholly right out of the front here that Mr. Burton is very likely guilty of felony murder. That is a reasonable presumption here. But then there is a very important difference between felony murder and capital murder. Capital murder requires an additional element, which is a specific intent to kill. In Alabama, they call it a particularized intent to kill, but it's the same concept. And of course, the Alabama Supreme Court has made it extremely clear for decades, this is over the years, that particularized intent to kill means just that, particularized to the defendant on trial. It's not like there simply has to be an intent to kill by someone involved in the group, but yet that latter concept is what was told to the jury. The prosecutor in this case told the jury that under accomplice liability and all this, that Mr. Burton, and this is the exact quote from the case, is equally guilty in the eyes of the law. Now, that is true for felony murder, but it is not true for capital murder. His own attorney did not explain any of what I'm explaining to you now. Did not correct that. And to put the cherry on the cake, the jury instructions then on intent told the jury that they could find the requisite intent for this crime if they find that Mr. Burton intended to participate in the crime. Then in the very next sentence, they're talking about something else and they say they reference the murder. Well, if you're referencing, why wouldn't you just talk about the murder the whole time if it's the murder that you're talking about? The crime to most people is going in and robbing the AutoZone store. And that certainly was a crime. And he certainly was guilty of, and he did have intent to go in and rob the AutoZone store. So all of these concepts were misconveyed to the jury, which ends up in just if it weren't so very serious, it would almost be a comedy of errors. I mean, I'd be making jokes about this being a Lemony Snicket's novel or something, a series of unfortunate events.
I have a couple of questions right now, just because I don't want us to move on without, and we forget. Number one,
yeah.
So, but he's not charged with capital murder. He's charged with felony murder, right?
No, he was charged with capital.
Oh, he was charged with capital. Okay, this is where I was looking.
Yes.
Number one.
Yes.
The other question I have is, it went to trial because of that charge. He did not plead, or they did not offer him anything, or.
To be honest, they did offer him life without parole.
Okay.
And he declined to accept that. He figured he would never get the death penalty for this. He didn't kill anyone, so he declined that option. But I don't want to hide that they did offer him.
Okay.
Life. Yeah. So Matt, if we break that down. Basically, we have Sonny. We know he intended to rob the AutoZone. He did. He leaves before the shooting, and yet the jury instruction makes it look like his intent to commit the robbery makes him guilty of capital murder. Meanwhile, Derek DeBruce, the actual shooter who commits the murder, what eventually happens with his capital murder conviction?
And here's this little pièce de résistance that comes in here that blows people's minds when they then hear that Derek DeBruce later had his sentence overturned, and the state fought that, but the state could have gone forward with another resentencing hearing and tried to get another capital punishment for him, and they chose not to. So the shooter, Derek DeBruce, was resentenced to life without parole. Meanwhile, here, Mr. Burton remains on death row, and now they're planning to execute him. And this is the most amazing part to me. During those appeals, that situation is so unusual and so unjust that the state itself admitted in their pleading that that is arguably unjust to have that dichotomy with the lesser culpable person being removed from death row with the more culpable person remaining on. So I really want to emphasize that point because we're talking about the credibility of not only a judicial system, but the credibility of the governor, the credibility of the attorney general's office, and the credibility of Alabama's entire system of government. When the state of Alabama, through its attorney general, on the record to a court under oath, stated that this is arguably unjust, I would put forth that if a state, if a government looking to impose its most severe and most irreversible penalty of execution cannot stand up and state with absolute confidence and no hesitation that this is a just act, that act should not go forward. And I would put forth to you that people across the political spectrum agree with that concept, as have many conservative Republican governors, and as now do six of the eight living jurors in this case and the victim's own daughter.
Donna, I have a question about the other defendants as well. If all of them were charged in some way with other, like, murder-related charges, like, what kind of became of the others? Are there others who committed felony murder and also are on death row, or it was just ended up Sonny?
No, they're not on death row, but I do think it's important to note that they all were charged with capital murder, including the 16-year-old co-defendant who was the one who testified against Mr. DeBruce and Mr. Burton. And at that time, a 16-year-old could be sentenced to death. So any testimony he gave, well, I mean, he took a plea in exchange for his testimony. And, you know, I think you all know where that leads. So Mr. DeBruce died in custody after he was resentenced. I think that was in 2020. Mr. McCants, which is he's the 16-year-old. He was 17 at the time that he testified. He's in custody now on an unrelated charge. He, you know, eventually got, you know, free from this conviction. Mr. Long has passed away. Mr. Brantley is still in custody.
On this charge, mm-hmm. on this offense. Okay. Serving life.
Yes.
Serving life.
Yes, ma'am.
So Sonny Burton is the only one facing the death penalty in this case.
That's
period.
Correct.
Okay. I also, so I'm guessing this went through all the direct appeals and then were there post-conviction appeals? I don't know. But this has been a clemency case for a very long time now, right? And as you create this clemency case, it is extraordinary that a lot of the jurors are on board and the victim's family. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I'm not sure which one you want to.
Let's go with the six out of the eight surviving jurors to start. What is kind of the basis of their statement that we don't want to see him executed?
Sure. Yeah. Why don't I talk about that? I was the one kind of out talking with most mm-hmm. of them and, you know, knocking on doors and seeing what they thought about things. It was really interesting speaking with them. We, of course, two of them just didn't want to talk about it. They don't want to make any public statement. They just don't want to have anything to do with it. Four have passed away. So that left us with six to speak with. Of the six with whom we spoke, initially, right after Derek DeBruce was resentenced to life without parole. We figured we'd go talk to them and just see, you know, I mean, what are your thoughts on this? And then later we went back and we're talking with people again. Throughout the course of that entire period, we ended up with three of the jurors who right away said, you know, I would have, under that circumstance, no problem with the governor commuting the sentence, and, you know, would not oppose that, and that would be fine with me. So three were that far. Three went even further and said, I want to write a letter to the governor and specifically asking the governor to commute the sentence, stating that I never would have voted for death in the first place had I known that the shooter would not face the same fate. One of them went so far as to write an op-ed that was published in the paper and even ask for a meeting with the governor. And so, I mean, it's really remarkable here that you've got all the jurors who are even willing to talk about the case, half of the actual original jury that convicted him and a supermajority of those still living supporting clemency here. And even more amazing with the victim's daughter, of course, as well. I mean, yeah.
I am in that part of my life where middle age is upon me. I've got perimenopause hanging over my head. I am doing all the serums and the supplements and everything I can, not just to hang on to younger looking skin and energy and all the things that we try to slow down, you know, as we get older. But the truth is this, better than all the serums and supplements is really just a good night's sleep. On the nights that I can get a solid 7-8 hours of sleep, I wake up feeling my best. There is no cream, supplement, makeup that can rival how I look and how I feel on those good nights. Sleep is very, very precious to me, and it should be precious to all of us. And you will not get good sleep unless you have the kind of mattress that is designed to help you sleep cooler, longer, and more comfortably. And the Ghost Bed mattress line has just been redesigned last year to do exactly that. They have higher quality materials, a better feel, and they'll help you sleep longer at night. You can choose from three models. They're available in foam or hybrid with two firmness options, medium or medium firm. They have patented cooling technology and breathable materials that keep you cool all night, and they are ergonomic, zoned support layer relieves pressure and aligns your spine. Most importantly, they are luxury without the markup. Ghost Bed mattresses use premium materials and durability at prices up to 50% less than leading brands. That's why Ghost Bed has 60,000 plus five-star reviews. They were designed by sleep experts. They are a family-owned business. They've got 20 years of experience. They've been doing this for a long time. It'll make you feel good to know also, not only do they use premium materials, but they are handcrafted and made in the USA and Canada. With a Ghost Bed mattress, you get a 101-night at-home sleep trial on every one of their mattresses and pillows. You get a 20-plus-year warranty, which is 2 times the industry standard. And you also get free shipping and returns on mattresses, and most of the products will ship to you in 24 hours. The Ghost Bed Lux is called the coolest bed in the world for a reason. It is the most popular of all their mattresses, and it features their signature Ghost Ice cooling technology that has 8 layers of comfort and a balanced medium feel. The Ghost Bed mattress is something you can rely on every single day to give you the kind of sleep you need to be optimal when you get up in the morning. Right now, as a listener, you can take an extra 10% off your order. Just go to ghostbed.com/justice and use promo code justice at checkout. Don't you deserve to sleep well? I promise you, you do. Once again, that's ghostbed.com/justice. Use code justice for an extra 10% off site-wide. Upgrade your sleep with Ghost Bed. Makers of the coolest beds in the world. Some terms apply. See site for details. On the jurors, you know, it's interesting to me that they changed their mind given the fact that the actual shooter's, you know, sentence was changed, not necessarily in the fact that they were given incorrect jury instructions. Did they know that they were even given incorrect jury instructions?
You know, it's interesting. When we spoke with them, a number of them told us, and some of them put this in their letters as well, very beautifully, that they really struggled with this for years. Some of them One spoke with us for quite a while. He was sitting on his tractor outside of his little place, and we had a really nice conversation, and he was very honest with us. He said that he had many sleepless nights over this, a lot of stress. This was a very traumatic thing for him to have to go through, and that he had always struggled just with the fact that they had sentenced a non-shooter to death, but that they did feel that by the everything that they were told that was what they were supposed to do. This many years later, they don't really remember exactly, you know, they don't remember what the jury instructions were or what they exactly heard. But when I explained to them those concepts and said that, you know, that here I could show them from the transcripts, here's what the prosecutor told you, and that's actually incorrect. It did disappoint many of them. And they did feel like they were confused and that they did not fully understand. They thought that they were supposed to follow everything that they were supposed to follow in the jury instructions, and that they were told by the prosecutor, this is what the case says. The jury instructions kind of said that too, and that's how they had to vote.
I mean, did the jury vote on the sentence as well, or it was just the conviction?
It was both. Okay. And that whole entire thing is fascinating in and of itself, the sentencing hearing. And it brings up, and I've been able to say it in a way because it gets way off into the weeds on some legal issues that may be too difficult for people to grasp.
Not for our audience, Matt. You can get
So I think your audience is definitely sophisticated enough to get this. So as you, most of your audience is probably aware, in 1997, a law was passed at the federal level called AEDPA, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. One of the main provisions of it is that the federal courts, in a nutshell, the federal courts cannot grant relief if the state court decision is wrong. They can only grant relief if the state court decision is wrong and clearly contrary to clearly established federal law. But even there, clearly established federal law has its own unique definition, which means only the specific holdings of the U.S. Supreme Court. Sonny had an issue in his case regarding the calling of witnesses. Now, every jurisdiction in the United States of America, and I have filed briefs on this where I've literally listed out cases from all 50 states, Guam, Puerto Rico, every circuit, and the United States Supreme Court, have all said a million times that the calling of witnesses, the decisions as to which witnesses to call, that is for the attorney to make, not the client, because the attorney is the only one in the middle of the trial who's going to understand what other evidence this may open the door to that previously was kept out, that sort of thing. And that is exactly what happened here. This is going to blow your mind. Mr. Burton's attorney stood up and told the court that, and this was at the sentencing phase. And at this time, Mr. Burton didn't even understand that he had been convicted, and he didn't understand all what was going on. He still wanted these two witnesses called. He wanted two of his co-defendants called. His attorney didn't want to call them, and he didn't have a lot of good communication with his attorney, so his attorney didn't really explain it to him. But his attorney had a very good reason why he didn't want them called, because they were both going to testify that they didn't know Mr. Burton. But the state had a video of them casing out a bank on the same day of the crime, which had previously been excluded because that would be prejudicial to the crime. But if you get on the stand and you say, I don't know this guy, they can then put this video on and say, oh, you most certainly do. And that here's what happened. So obviously his attorney wasn't going to call the witnesses. In any court in the United States, that would just be that. That's the attorney's call. Here, the trial court said, oh, no, that's Mr. Burton's call. You must call those witnesses. And he ordered him to call the witnesses. So he called the witnesses and they testified they didn't know him. The prosecutor showed the tape, said, this is, you know, he's still under their dominion and they're following him. He was the ringleader that infuriated the jury. And then that also explains why you end up with a death sentence in this case. Well, we appealed that. And clearly we're right. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court has even said it over and over again. The calling of witnesses is for the attorneys. All the rules of professional evidence in every jurisdiction say that. Even the Alabama rules of professional responsibility say that. Even other Alabama courts have said that. And yet in Mr. Burton's case on appeal, the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals signed an order written by the Attorney General's office that just said, no, the calling of the witnesses, that was Mr. Burton's call. Now, that's totally wrong. Every other court in the United States of America would say that's wrong. And yet, think about it. Because that principle is so incredibly widely established,
right?
It's never happened before.
It hasn't been litigated before. Happened.
So it never went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's never been a holding of the U.S. Supreme Court.
The irony.
So here, Mr. Burton, in this cruel irony, cannot get relief in the federal courts because the principle is so widely established that it's not even a holding of the U.S. Supreme Court because it's never even needed to be. And you think about it, and that's above and beyond all the other injustices that happened in this case. And it's really just, once again, I think this is a quintessential case for clemency. This is what clemency is there for, to stop this type of thing that slipped through the cracks. And these are cracks. I mean, there's a crack in AEDPA, in the law, that allowed this to slip through. There were all of these other things that happened, misstatements of law to the jury, jury instructions that were confusing, everything. All these things happened that caused something to happen that, when I tell people that he didn't kill anybody, that alone makes people, they don't believe me at first. They're like, well, then he can't be on death row. Well, oh, yes, he can. And not only can he, but they're planning on executing him a week from last night.
Donna, can you tell us a little bit about whether there are others in Alabama who have been convicted of felony or who have been, well, he was convicted of capital murder is the thing, though. He actually was not convicted of felony murder, which is where I was confused. But a similar situation in the, I mean, is there no precedent in Alabama where, like, something like that? Is it just because the conviction, it's clearly, the conviction itself has to be vacated. And I'm, you know, because it was not capital murder. I can't get my head around that to begin with. But anyhow, Donna, can you tell us a little about the history of Alabama and the death penalty?
I don't know where to start with that. I mean, obviously, I think everyone knows Alabama's a little bit conservative, and the laws don't apply equally to everyone in Alabama. I would say Talladega County, where Mr. Burton was convicted and where several of my other clients were convicted and sentenced to death, has quite a reputation for seeking death sentences against poor Black men. And that's exactly what Mr. Burton was. And at this time, there was a prosecutor, the Talladega County District Attorney during this time period was very, very tough on crime, I guess is what he would call it. He, you know, I would say indiscriminately sought death sentences.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
He wanted another notch on his belt. And, you know, I don't know the statistics, and I don't know every single case. I know there are others who are convicted in Alabama under a felony murder theory and sentenced to death, but I don't think there's anybody who can say, well, he didn't order it. he didn't even know about it. Like, that
wasn't
is
even
the,
in the building. Yeah.
Wasn't in the building. Didn't know. This other guy made an independent decision, you know, in the heat of the moment to shoot the victim. And Mr. Burton had no idea that was even happening. Like, that it is unique in that respect. And, you know, back to what Matt was saying just about the AEDPA, that is the reason why Mr. Burton has not been able to get relief on the claim related to whether he's guilty of capital murder. I noted because I just thought this was not funny, but it was very interesting. The federal district court judge who ruled on Mr. Burton's case obviously denied relief, but he noted at least three times in his order that the prosecutor was not a wordsmith, that he said that his arguments were jumbled and incoherent. So, I mean, it's not unremarkable that the jurors maybe didn't understand what this guy was arguing. I would also say, you know, this is in the clemency petition. I'm just reading from it, but it was notable that this judge did accept Mr. Burton's contention that the state did not produce a witness who testified that Burton possessed the individualized, particularized intent to kill anyone. But he was bound by the state court's findings. So if you get railroaded in state court, good luck in federal court.
And that's the difficulty, yeah, of this act, yeah.
Omaha Steaks semi-annual sale is here. It's a sale so nice, they do it twice a year. Save 50% site-wide on the world's best proteins, like legendary steaks, gourmet burgers, versatile chicken, pork, seafood, and more. Plus, get an extra $35 off with code AUDIO when you shop OmahaSteaks.com today. Now is the time to save big on everything you need to serve up mouth-watering flavor, like USDA-certified tender steaks, perfectly aged to maximize tenderness and hand-cut by master butchers in America's heartland and delivered right to your door. With unrivaled quality and variety, every bite is backed by their 100% satisfaction guarantee. Don't wait. Shop now at omahasteaks.com and save 50% site-wide on steaks and more during the semi-annual sale. Plus, get an extra $35 off with promo code AUDIO at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code AUDIO. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. Omaha Steaks semi-annual sale is here. Save 50% site-wide on legendary steaks, gourmet burgers, chicken, pork, seafood, and more. Plus, get an extra $35 off with promo code AUDIO at omahasteaks.com. Shop now to save 50% site-wide on steaks and more during Omaha Steaks semi-annual sale. Plus, get an extra $35 off with promo code AUDIO at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code AUDIO. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details.
And another thing that, Matt, you know, I mean, this is so critical in any clemency application, but certainly something where the governor of a state is deciding whether to spare someone from death row. It's those statements by the family members. And you touched upon earlier, we have the victim here, Doug Battle. His daughter, Tori, was 9 years old when she lost her father. And you mentioned that she supports clemency in this case. And so what is her position that she's come forward with in terms of asking for clemency for Sonny?
Yeah, she has been amazing in this. She's a very private person, and yet she's been brave to, number one, write a letter to the governor, stating to her in the letter, and that letter's open to the public, that's part of the clemency application, as well as she went on to write an op-ed, an opinion editorial in the paper as well. In her letter, and she appeared in the clemency video, she asked us to blur her image, and again, for her privacy, but she spoke so beautifully and eloquently about her journey on this. And she admitted that she had been confused for many years. She really hadn't been informed as to what was going on. She just knew this man had been convicted of killing her father, as well as Derek DeBruce. She had been unaware until she just got notice that DeBruce was resentenced to life without parole. She hadn't previously known who was who. She had previously supported their executions, but Mr. Burton had written a letter, a public apology letter, to the victim's family. And through what's known as defense victim outreach, which is a very gentle process. I mean, we went through a third party who knows how to handle these sorts of things, just simply to offer his letter to the family, as well as if there's any other information that we as a defense team can provide. And that's about it. And we open up that opportunity. She accepted his letter, read it, and then she ended up, you know, beautifully forgiving him. I mean, above and beyond just saying that this would be okay to commute his sentence, she forgave him. So there's been that beautiful reconciliation there. But then she also has now publicly, again, both in the letter and in the clemency video and in an op-ed, stated that she supports the death penalty still to this day, but she does not support it for Mr. Burton, this man who was convicted technically of killing her father, even though he did not kill him and did not pull the trigger.
What about the victim's widow and other children? Or
no one has wanted to make any sort of public statement at all. And of course, we respect that totally.
Yeah. So. And now in this case, if Governor Ivey gives clemency, important for our listeners to know, he's still going to remain behind bars. And some of the reporting I've seen in terms of him mentoring younger inmates, et cetera, can you kind of speak to what Sonny is currently like physically, as well as in these mentorship roles to these younger inmates in the prison?
Sure. You know, first physically, and I wish we could pop a picture of him up on the screen here, but physically, Sonny is just you'll see it if you go to his website. He is what you see on the website there. He is a frail old 75-year-old man, and he looks, in the sense of his bodily frailty, much older than 75. He is wheelchair bound. He has to wear a helmet all the time because he can only stand sometimes, and some days he can stand and he can walk some. This is a beautiful quick side story. One of my other clients actually helped him walk again by doing physical therapy with him. And after they had told him he probably would never walk again. And so he can walk a little bit, but he has to wear a helmet at all times. He's in the infirmary most of the time. He's been in the infirmary about the last few months. He got a spider bite about 8 weeks ago that was really bad, dead flesh all around his knuckle. They got him on IV antibiotics, and actually that has given him a real upswing. Now he's doing much better. His color's better. He's put on about 15 pounds, and he's doing well on that. So in terms of, you know, that's what he is as this frail mm-hmm. person. What was the other part of the question, Colin? I'm sorry.
This mentorship role that he has played to some of the younger inmates and how he's been in connection with the correctional officers and the other inmates.
Yeah, you know, this is such a remarkable person that I actually put in the clemency petition. You know, and I can't go and ask the warden or, you know, people up there to give me an affidavit on his behalf or something. People aren't going to do that sort of thing. They've got their jobs to protect. And I'm not speaking for him or anyone else. But I was confident enough just knowing what Sonny is like in that prison and how much the guards and nurses and everyone in there loves him. I was absolutely confident just putting in the clemency petition, welcoming the governor to call the warden, call ADOC officials who have ever met Mr. Burton, call the guards, speak with them about him, find out about this man and what he's like, because he's just beloved in there. And we've seen people in there in tears these last few weeks, guards getting choked up, other staff getting choked up, people like him. And I wouldn't speak for any of them individually, but I'm just saying, you know, they really do like him. And in terms of the mentorship, you know, Sonny has always really reached out to the members of his family, said, don't make the mistakes I made. Look at what happened to me. And he's trying to also reach out to a lot of these younger people who are coming into the prison. And he tells me about how wild they are and they think that they got to fight and do all these other things in prison. And he's trying to guide them into different ways of being able to handle things in prison, and that there are ways that you can live in there, at least in a reasonably peaceful way with other people, if you work with other people and this type of thing. So he's really been a good influence on people. He wants to be in any way that he can, which is remarkable given that he can't get out of his cell a lot, given that he is in a wheelchair. But yeah, he's a terrific guy.
Donna, I have a question about the clemency petition. I, you know, the governor's name has come up a couple of times, but the petition's in front of a court, right?
No, it's actually in front of...
It's with the governor's office.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And what is also, okay, can you explain a little bit about how clemency petitions work? And then what is also the role of the Supreme Court, if there is one, the Alabama Supreme Court in a case like this?
Okay, so how an execution proceeds in Alabama typically, and I don't think this is actually written down, but the Alabama Attorney General's office moves for the Alabama Supreme Court to authorize the governor to set not a date, but a time frame now. That rule changed a couple of years ago. But so the AG moves for the Alabama Supreme Court to authorize the governor to set an execution time frame. We respond as the attorneys in the Alabama Supreme Court. Then they either, you know, grant or deny the request of the AG. I mean, typically they grant it. And then the governor then decides, you know, whether she's going to set a date or not. And so she did set a date in this case. And we actually submitted this clemency petition a little bit earlier than we normally would, I would say, because we wanted to give her plenty of time to consider whether she, you know.
When did you submit it? How long had you had it?
It was December 10th. And that was actually the same day that our response was due in the Alabama Supreme Court. And so she, you know, she decided on February, I guess they authorized it sometime in January. And then she decided February 6th, I believe, to set the date for March 12th. And so the petition is still pending in front of her. You know, she's made a couple of statements, I believe, publicly that she does not, you know, have current plans to grant clemency in this case. But she can change her mind all the way up to the time it's carried out on March 12th. And so it is our hope that she will. And the hope of a lot of people, at least, you know, I think we're up to 60,000 signatures on his clemency petition, mm-hmm. you know.
The online petition, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and let me remind listeners, in case you didn't remember, we did a deep dive investigation and presented the Rocky Myers case on the podcast. And we asked you to contact Governor Ivey about commuting Rocky's sentence from a death sentence to a life sentence. And last year, she did listen to all the voices reaching out, some from our podcast, many other organizations out there, and she commuted Rocky's sentence. And so if you're wondering, is there a possibility that she changes her mind and grants clemency? Absolutely. And those voices, especially for listeners in Alabama, please reach out to her.
Matt, is this the first time a date has been set? I mean, he's been behind bars a long time.
Yes, this is the first time that a date has been set. This was the first time they had sought one for any number of reasons. We had a lot of things pending that were precluding that. And then once they started executions back up, they've kind of been going mm-hmm. in an order. We knew that he was the next likely candidate for a date. But yes, this is his first time on that.
Hey, this is Bayard Winthrop, founder of American Giant. I started this company because I was fed up with cheap clothes that didn't last and a system that shipped manufacturing overseas. We believed we could still make incredible hoodies, t-shirts, and pants right here in the U.S. with American cotton, American factories, and people earning real wages. That's what American Giant stands for, building clothes that actually last. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code GIANT20. At American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com. This is Bayard Winthrop, founder of American Giant. We make all our clothing right here in the U.S. with American cotton and American workers. Get 20% off your first order when you use code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com.
You mentioned during a press conference, you used the word suffocate a number of times. Can you talk about that? What is the method of execution in Alabama?
Yes. The method of execution, they actually have two. And this is a little bit complex, but for years they had lethal injection. That was the first, you know, and I've been blessed to be on some teams that have gotten two people off and lead some teams that have gotten two people off of death row, but I've unfortunately had to witness three executions, and I hope it's not four next week. But the suffocation question. Yeah. So I have witnessed two of these, and I try to be very careful when I talk about this because there are such wildly divergent reports from different sides as to what happens with the nitrogen executions. I have witnessed two of them, and I have testified under oath as to what I witnessed because I was subpoenaed and called when someone else was challenging the protocol. I'm not sure how deep you want me to get into it, but I would just say that what the process essentially is, and I don't think the state would disagree with this first part of it, but it's what it is, and this is gruesome to talk about, but there is a gas mask on the person's face, we're not talking about like a small surgical mask, we're talking about like a rather,
full face mask.
Yes, a full sort of face gas mask, the type that you would picture somebody walking out of a burning building in, sort of thing, not necessarily the huge ones, but you know, very solidly covering the full face. They are strapped to a gurney. All the normal things happen where they come in and they read the warrant and they allow him to make a final statement and those sorts of things. And when they announce that the procedure is going to begin, it's pretty clear, at least as a lay witness, and again, I'm not an expert, but just as a lay witness, it was very clear, especially having seen two of these, that they are very well aware when the airflow has changed. Now, to be clear to the public, nitrogen itself does not hurt your lungs. It does not burn your lungs. I want to be open about that. I'm breathing 70% roughly nitrogen right now as I'm breathing. It was the same if you've ever taken a helium balloon and inhaled on it. You're just not getting any oxygen. It's not hurting your lungs. It just makes your voice sound funny. But in this situation, The prisoners, of course, know that when the air starts blowing, at that point, they are getting only nitrogen in the mask. So even though it's not burning their lungs, they are going to be aware that they're not catching their breath and that they're starting to see stars and all of that. And the Attorney General's office's position, the state's position, has always said that they're unconscious within 40 seconds. There have been experts testify that they are conscious up to 4.5 minutes or so, I believe. And there have been activists who have come out saying that they're conscious and thrashing around for 20 minutes. I personally don't think that it does any benefit to the cause to exaggerate things to that extent, because what's happening is horrible enough that to just be straightforward with what's happening. If you want me to just state it bluntly, the person does look terrified and panicked and are straining up against the restraints as if they're trying to struggle for air for anywhere from about a minute and a half to a minute and 45 seconds to somewhere in that range. And then somewhere in between about a minute and 45 seconds and 2:15 to 2:30, both of them, and this was bizarre, and I had no expectation that this would happen, and it was even more bizarre when it happened the second time. Both of them, they lifted their legs up in the air, almost like a Pilates-type style move. Their legs lifted up into the air, their head also raised a little bit, and then as their legs were going down, and their head also went down, and slumped to the side. And so being honest at that point as a lay person, if I'm seeing someone panicking and I'm seeing their eyes darting about and all of this, and then I'm seeing that, I can't help but presume at that point that they are either unconscious or very close to unconsciousness. Otherwise, they probably would still be issuing the signs of panic at that point. So it, to me, that's still a whole, when you think about, even if your lungs are not burning, you're fully conscious that entire time that you are being deprived of oxygen, you are being suffocated from receiving air. There's really, there would be obviously physical pain involved with this. I mean, your heart's going to be pounding, all of the stress and everything that comes with it.
I mean, it would be involuntary as well. Your body is deprived of oxygen. I mean, yes. Like, you know, anybody who's experienced that, even in an asthma attack, understands. I mean, like, how terrifying that
more
is.
But even more the psychological terror, I think, of this, which could all be alleviated if they would simply sedate the person beforehand. Then they would not even be conscious while this is happening. Yeah, but the state has refused to do that.
Yeah, and to put that into context so our listeners understand, for years, not without its issues, but there was this three-drug cocktail for lethal injection. And under that, the inmate was unconscious. And so, Matt, when you spoke to bringing back the death penalties, at least one of the drugs in the three-drug cocktail, unavailable now. And that is why, as you know, they shifted to this new, I mean, it's relatively new, right? 2024, maybe, that they brought this gas in as the method of execution.
Very, very new. There have only been a handful of them. And you are correct. Some of the drugs that can be used to knock someone out are now unavailable for execution purposes, which we're grateful for. The company saying, we don't want our drugs used for this. But at the same time, there are things that would be, I mean, even fentanyl can be made, you know, even compounded by the state if they wanted to. So those sorts of things could be done to render a person to where they're
I mean, I'm like Valium. I mean, like, just there's so many things that could just, like,
that sort of thing. Now, to be honest, a little bit, because I don't want to make it sound like they would refuse to give them anything at all. The mental, and this is not part of the protocol or anything else. It's just that the mental health staff at the prison, or even just the doctor's staff, if you're not seeing mental health, if you go in and you say, I am having situational anxiety due to this, they will give you something strong, Xanax or something like that, during this process. And they also will generally, if they want it, they will give them a fairly high dose of that. The legally at max, I believe, like 5 milligrams of Xanax that last day, if they want that, to just sort of help keep them calm. That does, of course, not sedate them. I mean, but they do give them that if requested. And I don't want to, again, I like to just be thorough and not misrepresent.
Can I add something about the nitrogen hypoxia?
Yeah, of course.
Because I find this to be awful. I think that both of these methods are unconstitutional, how they currently do the lethal injection and how they are doing the nitrogen hypoxia. I do. But, you know, we are stuck with some case law from the United States Supreme Court that, you know, a person that wants to challenge a method of execution has to prove a feasible and readily implemented alternative. Alabama was the first state to carry out an execution with nitrogen hypoxia. And that was in 2024, like you said, Colin. But everyone who was on death row in 2018 with no protocol in place, just, you know, what people thought would happen, what a legislator thought would happen, as the description of what this method was going to be, they had to make a choice. And they had 30 days in which to make a choice under Alabama law, what method of execution they wanted, whether nitrogen hypoxia or lethal injection. And so Mr. Burton made that choice because, I mean, I'm assuming because, you know, it seemed like well, it can't be any worse. You know, it was not an informed choice.
Yeah, especially at the time, assuming that there would be sedation involved. Yeah.
And listeners, you know, to Donna's point, if you want to know how critical I find this issue, when I was in law school, my student note for law review was on executions and the drugs used and all that. And so a death by any other name, if you want to look it up, I sort of go into detail on the brutality of a lot of these execution methods.
We are hoping that none of you will have to go through any of this next week. And now what I want to know is what our listeners can do. Colin, you a little while ago said, you know, if you're in Alabama, and what about people who are not in Alabama? So I want Donna, Matt, both of you to tell our listeners, what can we do to make sure this doesn't happen?
Well, if you're not in Alabama, you can still support. I know there's stuff, you know, being planned as we speak. We have been,
you know, there's vigils, there's marches.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. We've been offered graciously by the Julius Jones Institute assistance on the ground here next week in Montgomery with, you know, demonstrations, prayer vigils. One thing that the Julius Jones Institute brought to our attention and is helping to plan, I believe, in conjunction with the Faith Leaders of Color Coalition, is a prayer vigil on Monday night, and that is going to be over Zoom. So that is something that anyone can participate in. They're putting together a program, basically, with speakers.
And where would people find that? Like on his website?
It will be posted on the website. We are going to send out a newsletter. We've been sending out more or less weekly newsletters since the date was set by Governor Ivey, just to let people know what sort of events are being planned, how they can help. So that is one thing that anyone can participate in, is that Monday night, it's 7 p.m. Central, prayer vigil that's online. And then there is also going to be here in Montgomery that morning, so 7:30 a.m., we are going to be marching from the governor's mansion to the Capitol, which is where her office is, with three of Sonny's children are going to deliver the over 60,000 petition signatures directly to the governor's office, you know, to demonstrate just how much support there is for clemency in this case. So that's going to be live streamed, I believe. And the reason we chose that time is it's been part of what we've been doing ever since. And I say we, but I mean, you know, yes, the legal team's there, but it's a massive amount of support that we're getting from members of the community here in Alabama. So every Monday since the date was set, from 7:30 to 8:30, folks have been out in front of the governor's mansion with signs. They say Save Sonny, or they say a number of things. People make their own signs as well. And so, you know, just letting people know, like, hey, this is happening, and it's happening in your name. That's been every week. There was actually, the second week was a 24-hour vigil. That was on February 16th. That was a federal holiday, so a lot of people were off work. That's why we, you know, chose that day. It was also 24 days before the planned execution. So that was 24 hours of folks, you know, outside the governor's mansion. We had, you know, a number of speakers. We were, you know, working in collaboration with Death Penalty Action for that. It was live streamed. I think that's still up, you know, if anyone's interested in seeing, you know, kind of what that looked like. They brought the Delaware bell, which is the bell that was rung outside of every execution in Delaware until they got rid of the death penalty. And now it travels from state to state. It spends a lot of time in Florida, and I guess probably Alabama. It probably will spend a lot of time here, too. So, yeah, there's the Mercy Monday March. There's the Prayer Vigil Monday night, which is online. And then I know that there is currently in the works a plan to be out in front of the Capitol on Thursday. If we get to that point, 6 hours for Sonny is what that's being currently called. More information to come. Like I said, things are just coming together.
You know, please do contact the governor's office. This is not in any way, shape, or form hopeless. There have been other governors in other states, and I guess these are the most beautiful examples, because there have been extremely conservative Republican pro-death penalty governors in capital punishment heavy states like Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, but across the political spectrum, Republicans and Democrats, where the governors have commuted sentences in very similar situations. where the lesser culpable individual was about to be executed and the more culpable had been spared that fate, recognizing that that's not what the death penalty was supposed to be, that that would be a stain on their state's justice systems, that it slipped through the cracks, and so they've done the right thing. Those include Governor Perry of Texas, who oversaw, I believe, 273 executions. He only commuted, I believe, two sentences. One of them was almost identical to Mr. Burton's. Governor Abbott commuted a sentence in Texas, also hardly some sort of, you know, liberal anti-death penalty person. But he commuted the sentence of a man who had even arranged to have the murder take place, but he was still the lesser culpable individual, and the more had been alleviated from that. And so he understood that that principle was important. And most recently, Governor Kevin Stitt of Oklahoma. And that's the one that strikes me the most, because he did it at the last minute. And at the last minute, he even though there was an execution set, he commuted the sentence of Tremaine Wood. Again, a lesser culpable individual, the more culpable had been spared the death penalty. Same situation. So we would ask Governor Ivey really to look at her colleagues that she trusts and respects and whose example that she should follow, and recognize that again, clemency was made for a situation like this, where this slipped through the cracks, particularly, again, because I got to always keep bringing it back to this, when the state itself has admitted that this is arguably unjust.
And we're talking about a defendant who is still going to spend the rest of his natural life behind bars, who is 75, who is wheelchair bound. I mean, just the idea of this frail man being strapped to a gurney. Matt, what do you, have you heard anything from the, like, how does that work? Like, are you in communication with the governor's office? And you mentioned how this Oklahoma clemency, like, for its very last minute, is that the kind of thing you often see in Alabama?
There have only ever been two commutations in Alabama.
Okay.
One was of a woman many decades ago. In recent times, there's only been one. I will give credit, that one was Governor Ivey. And so we also have that hope here as well, that she will, again, have that courage to do the right thing. And especially in this case where, you know, any public blowback would be minimal. We've even had conservative radio talk show hosts here in Montgomery coming on board, writing their own articles on conservative news sites, 1819news.com, saying they support the death penalty, but they would absolutely commute Mr. Burton's sentence under these circumstances. So we're really hoping that she will just hear all of those messages and do the right thing.
Thank you, Matt and Donna, for joining us. I know it was very last minute. We will be dropping this episode really days before the execution date, but it will be before that. However, today, in fact, I will put today on Friday, March 6th, I will post on our social media and direct folks to go to Sunny's website to try to get folks to try to communicate with the governor's office over the next few days as well. Any other way we can support you, please let us know. And, send our thoughts, prayers, and love to Sunny, please.
Absolutely.
We absolutely will. I'll probably be speaking with him later today. And thank you for giving us this opportunity. I mean, we just want to get his word out there, and we appreciate all the efforts you've made to help us do that.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. It's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions, because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.